The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Truth and Justice. Thanks for joining us today for this very special episode. I am joined by our good friends, Dr. Shiloh and Dr. Scott of the LA Not So Confidential podcast. And we're here today to talk about all things from ethics and true crime reporting to them returning from their hiatus. And we're even going to have a little sneak peek at a big episode that they have coming up at the end of the month. Dr. Shiloh and Dr. Scott, how are you guys?
Hey, we're great. Thanks for having us on.
Yeah, this is really cool. And thank you for kind of introducing us to this whole idea. I mean, this has enhanced our pod as well as doing these little Patreon member only live streams. And our listeners love it. So thanks for inspiring us.
We stole your pregame is what he's saying. We call it shrink wrap, R-A-P, by the way.
Shrink wrap is the LA Not So Confidential pregame.
It is.
Yeah, so there you guys go. If you guys are LA Not So Confidential listeners, you better get on their Patreon and watch their pregame. But don't leave our Patreon to go to theirs. You should be on both.
No. Yes, it's totally doable.
Yeah. So hey guys, the first thing I want to talk about, was it about a month or two ago you guys wrote something up for Vice about ethics in true crime reporting. So tell me about that. How did that come to be and kind of share your thoughts on that? We'll just kind of spin off from there.
Scott, you want to talk about how is Nick the journalist?
Yeah. So the writer Nick is this really just an awesome guy who has been doing, I guess, freelance for Vice for several years. And recently he was taken on full time and he's consulted with us on a couple of articles that are definitely true crime related. They haven't been published yet. These are sort of he's really doing a deep dive into a particular phenomenon that's going on right now, which I would love to tell you about because it is so juicy and amazing, but we have to let that sit. But he reached out to us because we had been talking, you know, at conferences and kind of putting our 2 cents worth in about ethics and true crime. And so he gave us the opportunity to be interviewed formally about that subject. And it ended up being this, you know, like really tight little article for Vice about how the perspective in this genre seems to be shifting. And, you know, we've been seeing it, I would say, really significantly for about the last 2.5 years. It seems to be more prevalent than it was before. And he gave us a great platform for looking at it through a mental health perspective, how our perspectives have changed since we started. So many years ago, back in 2017.
Yeah, I think when we came into creating content, you know, our idea was we just feel like the voices of somebody working in the field that we're working in wasn't there in true crime content. And honestly, I mean, we didn't come into this really discussing the ethics behind it. I mean, we had our own sort of professional ethics standards that we go by. And of course, adhere to that and probably a little bit beyond, because we just have to be super, super careful, not really commenting on cases that are currently active, certainly not in the Los Angeles area, and certainly not involving, you know, the law enforcement agencies that we work for or any of the other government agencies we work for or consult with. So we've had to be very, you know, tiptoe around some things that we don't want to get ourselves unnecessarily involved in. But it's not like we came in here as like, ethics crusaders or anything like that. We certainly have had to change and learn along the way too. And yeah, I mean, I would say maybe even like pre-COVID that we saw that starting to change quite a bit. So it was interesting that Nick came to us with this idea because we had for the last 2 years, so up to March of this year, every month we were doing a documentary review of a true crime documentary. And not just reviewing it as from our perspective, because listeners were like, hey, what do you think about this documentary? And for several years, we weren't really covering documentaries at all. So we found a way to do that. But we would bring a little bit of research and viewing it through a psych lens to our episodes. And then it has kind of morphed into us talking about these points that really make us feel good or make us feel bad after watching a certain true crime documentary.
So what are, I want to talk a little bit about, you both mentioned that in these last few years, there's been a shift in true crime content creation regarding ethics. Can you talk about what that shift is, what it is that you've noticed? Is it shifting in a good direction, in a bad direction?
I feel like it's shifted in the direction it should have been from the beginning, which is being more victim centric. You know, our first conference when we started this was a great experience. And we did have the experience of several people coming forward saying, oh, I want to talk to you about my favorite serial killer. And I remember my initial reaction. I was really taken aback. And I kind of said, I don't know if it's really the best thing to have a favorite serial killer. Like, to be fascinated by it is interesting. But, you know, there just seemed to be at that time, and that was back in 2017. And I know true crime had already been a thing, you know, way before that. But there was just this emphasis on the goriness, the grisliness. And I understand that that actually is an important element so that we don't downplay the brutality of some of the crimes that happen. But there is some nuance there to, let's not let the victims get lost in this discussion. You know, let's let the victims be elevated. And what can we learn from these losses in our communities? And certainly understanding, because of the work that I do, understanding the families of the victims and the families of the perpetrators that are sort of collateral damage in these types of events. And I just see it, the whole shift moving a lot more strongly in that direction.
Yeah, I would say that's the biggest shift, is like victim-centered, victim-focused victims and or their families, you know, being content creators and it coming from their mouths as it should, and at least having their input and or permission to move forward with some of this content.
I think that a lot of it, to me, it seems like it is an evolution in the true crime audiences. I think as a population in general, I think we've all been, and I think it's because of this medium, right? So if you go back 10 years ago or a little bit further than that, in order for someone to create any kind of content, true crime content for people to consume, it's a pitch process with a TV network. It's, you know, you can kind of equate it to the high school athletes trying to make it to the pros. I mean, it's a very small percentage of people that have these ideas were able to create any content to be consumed. So we as consumers of it were very limited on what we were able to see, whatever we could see on 2020 or Dateline or, you know, any of those shows. And then true crime podcasting became popular, and anyone with, you know, $100 and an Amazon account could start creating content. And they did. And by the thousands, people started creating all these. So I think over, and I'm curious if you guys agree with this, but to me, it seems like over that time, everyone has gotten flooded with all this content, and it's from all different types of creators doing all types of different things. And then I think that having that volume of content to consume then kind of opened up people's eyes to start deciphering between, oh, that's okay, that's not okay, I feel good about this.
Very good point. Yeah.
And I love that anyone can put anything out there. You know, if they have that microphone and they can figure out how to do it, I think that's great. Does it oversaturate? Sure. But, you know, quality stuff is going to rise to the top usually, mm-hmm. you know, some other, and everyone's definition of quality is different. So, and we are different as human beings. So we're going to be drawn to different types of content, which I don't, you know, shame anyone for, and whatever is interesting to you is interesting to you. You know, it's kind of like when, you know, I spent a decade of my life working with high-risk sex offenders, and people were like, how can you do that? And I'm like, I don't know, but I can. And there's someone cut from a cloth to work with every single population out there. It's just, at least somebody is, like, someone's doing the work, right? It's all for the greater good of prevention, of creating any more victims. But it, I don't know. I think it's interesting, especially like when, and I think he mentions it in the article, but when the, not documentary, but the Jeffrey Dahmer film came out, the Ryan Murphy one, right? People were very up in arms. There was a lot of like content creators going on social media saying like, do not watch this.
Yeah.
It was an interesting like moment to sit in for me, because here I was interested in the content. I wanted to watch it. But then I went to an event and I was there with one of Jeffrey Dahmer's victims' sisters, mm-hmm. and having a conversation with her, right? So here I am kind of straddling this weird place. Do I want to be told not to watch something? No, I mean, I think as humans, we can watch something, consume it, and then have our takeaways from it, that we shouldn't necessarily be shamed into what we watch and what we don't watch. I will say the other side of that coin is, you know, our content consumption does fuel revenue for individuals. And if you want to think about where that goes, that's also something as a consumer you have to decide on.
Yeah. And I think that like that's a great example, the Jeffrey Dahmer show that came out. I feel like if that show came out 10 years ago, it would be 5 years ago, even, it would have been like wildly consumed by everyone. It would have been a blockbuster hit, but so many of the people that like true crime content have, you know, like they have educated themselves. But I just, matter of fact, on our follow up just a couple days ago, I was talking about kind of my evolution and my kind of enlightenment. We were talking about prison conditions and how I always thought, well, if they're in prison, you know, fuck them. You know, right, it should be miserable in there. And then it was like this like stair step process of, oh, wait, not everybody in there is guilty. Well, then we should maybe have better conditions. And it's like, wait a minute, why does it, they're all human beings. Why does it matter if they're guilty or not? They should still have.
Yeah.
There's a lot of nuance there. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think it's a tough time. And I think that, you know, my goal has always been to affect real change. And if I ever feel like what I'm doing isn't affecting change, then I'll stop doing it. I've turned down opportunities to be a part of projects that I just think are gratuitous, and isn't there nothing bad, mm-hmm. there's nothing wrong with them, but I just had to take a step back and look at like what was the, you know, when I did the Forgotten West Memphis 3 documentary, there was a purpose, there was a mission when we came through, we're going to do this because we're going to try to figure out who killed those three little boys, and we're gonna force this issue, and we're going to bring this thing to a conclusion. There was a mission. And then these other projects that kind of will come my way sometimes, it's like, you're just trying to tell a story, and I don't tell stories. Yeah. Like that's not my thing. And again, there's nothing wrong with that, but that's just the lane that I don't want to live in that lane. It's not worth it to me.
Someone else will do it. Like that again, like, you know, that's for someone else who has that, you know, maybe storytelling ability. And it's interesting because as we spent 2 years reviewing these documentaries, one of the prongs that we would say made a good or an ethical true crime documentary was that it might not have been the most, you know, glamorous, sexy story, but it was a story that needed to be told. Like, there was no other platform for it really to be heard. And so this, like, it maybe it wasn't the most riveting watch, but it was a story that needed to be told. Like, that was certainly important. And so there's people out there that will do it.
Yeah. And you have to, the tricky part is, as you guys know, is, in order to do the work, to get the people to listen, to make the change that you're trying to make, you also have to make it interesting and entertaining to keep them. So it's like, it's such a weird line to toe all the time. It's like, you know, we need to have this great production so that people want to listen so that we can accomplish the goal that we're trying to accomplish.
Well, you bring up a really good point too, Bob, is like, there are some creators like yourself, like this is, you know, you're retired from your previous profession, but now this is your full-time gig.
Right.
Right. As well as teaching and all these other things that you do on the side. And that, I think that that sort of slightly puts the focus on, like, you do have to be aware of that. It's like, in order to support the people that support you, you have to finance, you know, there is a financial incentive there, as opposed to someone like Shiloh and I, where we would love to be, you know, anybody would love to be making some extra money, but ours isn't driven by that. But I do think that there's an overlap between either driven by making some money or not so driven by it, but still, again, having an idea of what's really important. It's one of the things, you know, you explained really beautifully in one of your shows, and I don't know if it was, it was one of your shows. It was the follow-up series, and it was about the cases that you cannot take for your own code. Like, it's right. You explained it so beautifully about saying, if there are children involved, I can't get into that. Like, if, you know, I can't go down that path. And I'm not doing justice to the way you said it, but I just thought, I love,
or like sexual assault victims that are still alive.
Right.
Right. Like, you're like, that is a post for you that will not be passed. And I just thought that was really, really highly, highly ethical for you to put it out there like that.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn. But hurry, these offers won't last forever. Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Rule number one is a living victim, never. I just won't. It's hard enough having living family members of victims. That's always, right. You know, it's always step one in my process before we start a season is at least contact them, make them aware of what we're doing and why we're doing it. But for a living victim, like I cannot re-traumatize someone and drag them through something like that. And I just won't do it. Not always the well-received from the people that want us to take those cases, but it's just not for me.
Well, I think what you're, you know, the way I interpret what you're saying is we can't be everything to everybody.
Right.
We just can't. And that's when we'll get, you know, generally our listener base is, I think, a certain type of listener, and our Patreon members are a certain type of member,
mm-hmm.
and people come to us for a certain type of story. And, you know, like, I know I hate to go by reviews because reviews are sort of written on the fly many times, but the ones that get like the most critique or hate is some really strange, innocuous little thing that they expected from us that we didn't do. And so they just rate you really low. And I'm like, wow, that's a really strange, you know, you listen to one episode and then the first thing you do is to criticize it, you know, I like that there is a shift that we're doing this. There was even a case I wanted to come to you with that I'll talk to you about offline sometime, but it is one of those where there are still alleged victims, and it gave me pause listening to you say that. And I was like, mm-hmm. Oh, totally get what he's talking about. I totally get it. And I love that you have that. I also wanted to say one of the things that I love about not even so much just the citizens detective movement that has sprung up out of this, but like I know that Reddit can be a cesspool sometimes, but I've also been on threads about long-term unsolved crimes, and the rules are held so beautifully where they say, don't come in here as a newbie and start throwing around stuff that we talked about 15 years ago.
Yeah.
Come in here, review the rules, review what has already been knocked off. Don't try and present this as new because we're not going to tolerate it. And I think that that's actually sort of a great marker for all of us. Like, let's not bring out the most outlandish stuff that just has been disproved and disproved and disproved.
Yeah. And we get that a lot too, especially, you know, I've been doing this for gosh, how long has it been? It's been going on 10 years now. So, you know, we constantly get new listeners. You know, there's such a huge, there's 1,000 episodes for people to go through. So I'll get like in my email box all the time, like, I just listened to season one, episode three, and this is what I think happened. And I'm like, okay.
You're like, cool story.
Like, girl, listen, you need to go back and finish that season. And then we cover it. Trust me, we cover it. There's 50 episodes.
Yeah, for sure. I think some of the other things that we found kind of make a good and ethical true crime documentary, aside from it being a story that needed to be told, was that we did really start to see documentaries where the victims were given the lead voices, if not the only voices. Like, yeah. 11 Minutes on is one of my our favorites that we reviewed from the mass shooting at Mandalay Bay in Las Vegas. Mm-hmm. They literally do not mention the shooter's name. They give him zero attention. It is just all storytelling of that night and the aftermath by everyone from first responders to different victims, like such a variety of victims that they talk to. It was so, so powerful. I mean, you get the idea of what they wanted to tell, certainly about those, you know, 11 minutes, but those we really found were the best, where you didn't come away feeling gross afterwards, yeah, or like it was exploitative to the person they're interviewing. Cause there's some of those too, where you're like, did they want to be there? Did they want to be asked those questions?
Yeah.
It's almost a feeling afterwards.
Yeah. And I want to give a shout out too, because a group of people that I think played a big role in a shift that at least the first people that were, I noticed very conscious decisions being made to make things victim centric and put the victims first, that literally changed the way that I viewed my content creation, is the team at Real Crime Profile, Jim and Laura and Lisa. I remember way back like 8-9 years ago, I remember when they started, discussing cases, and I don't remember what case it was, but I remember Jim kind of going off about how it doesn't matter what that person, what the perpetrator's name was. And they started using the hashtag, her name was, his name was, you know, whatever it is. Yeah. And everybody's got their feelings about any different content creator, whether they like him or don't like him. But that element of what they do at Real Crime Profile, to me, it seemed like I saw a noticeable shift after they went out on that limb and started doing it. Now you see so many different creators, myself included, that will always use those, you know, whenever I tweet or whatever about the West Memphis 3 case, I always include the hashtag, his name was Chris, his name was Stevie, his, mm-hmm, you know, his name was Michael. Because I think that, you know, there are people in this genre in podcasting that have like taken that leap, and it's put us in a position where you have, you know, consumers of content that will no longer tolerate the grossness of some of that stuff. And that, like they saw with the Jeffrey Dahmer show.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's interesting because in one of the worlds that Scott and I kind of cross over into professionally is the world of threat assessment, and, you know, a ton of research being done looking at mass shooters and school shooters. And we did our 100th episode. We tackled the topic of school shooters and what, mm-hmm, we kind of know now and the research. And it started off more journalistically, where they stopped naming the names of shooters and, mm-hmm, glorifying them and putting their names on the front of, or their pictures on the front of magazines. But it became an ethical integrity issue in journalism, because the research was showing that the contagion effect is a real thing, and that people emulate that behavior, and that we're trying as an industry, which rarely you see kind of media and law enforcement sort of agree on something, that how can we help reduce this problem from a bigger stance, is something that Scott and I have, you know, shifted to abiding by in our episodes. And we cover a lot of domestic terrorism, you know, threat assessment issues, shootings, you know, lone wolf type situations with grievances where people act out in that way in mass attacks. So yeah, it's been, you know, one of our shifts as well, especially in that, you know, type of offender.
Yeah. And it's interesting. It's on topic what you were just talking about, but, you know, I spent this last year teaching part-time at a high school. And it's been really eye-opening for me, like on that topic of like, school violence, school shootings, things like that, watching like the interactions and being part of discussions with interactions and problems that that kids have. And so yeah. it's like content like that, I think, that like needs to be consumed and for like teachers and administrators and schools and stuff need to be very aware of the causation, the threat assessment, like you're talking about. You know, because I've seen, you know, I've not had any situation where I was worried about a school shooting, but I've definitely had students come to me, you know, with problems, and it definitely popped immediately into my mind. Like, this needs to be handled. This needs to be dealt with, because if this gets brushed under the rug, this kid is at their wit's end. Like I'm glad you're thinking that way. Yeah, they have gone. They've reached a point where they're, you know, they're coming to me, not even administrator or a counselor, just a trusted teacher, to tell me about these problems. And so, you know, those are those instances where like that information needs to be put out there. Those documentaries need to be made. They need to be on the news to try to get ahead of some of those threats. Cause I never really thought about it much cause I wasn't in it, but when you're in the middle of it, I'm just thinking one particular instance in my head. And I just remember thinking like, something needs to, and I went to my principal and told him like, something needs to be done very directly and very immediately, because this is not a safe situation for this student. Yeah. And I don't know what's going to happen next if we don't fix it.
Well, I would say one of the great protective factors about that sort of general scenario you're presenting is that individual came to you.
Yeah.
And that is totally. Huge, huge protective factor right there. It's in isolation and darkness where this evolution towards violence can really escalate. So, yeah, I mean, it's why, you know, we used to talk about, you know, we have a couple of patron saints, you know, we have Reed Malloy, who's a fantastic forensic psychologist that's been around for years. And then Kevin Cameron out of Canada, who is a social worker who has dedicated his career towards really drilling down into formulating sort of, you know, an access model for looking at outliers that hit all of these particular criteria. And it's informed my work on a day-to-day basis. I just had one last week that I had to go down the questions, like, and not necessarily score it, but sort of like use my clinical skills. Like, okay, how much of a potential threat is this right now? Access to weapons, like pro-social activities, relationship with parents or caregivers. You know, it's something that every school needs to be educated on. So yeah, good on you for also going back to the administration. And for any educators out there listening, you have a radar internally located, just like a law enforcement officer does, just like an EMT, just like a psychologist or a mental health clinician. Use it, trust it, go and get consultation.
Yeah.
I think now that Bob's an educator, we should get him to join ATAP. And then he could come out to the conference that's at Disney Resort every year to learn about threat assessment. Educators come, law enforcement, mental health professionals. It's awesome.
Yeah, I don't know what that is, but I'm in. What is it?
I'll send it to you.
Yeah.
I'll send it to you.
Oh, it's an amazing organization. And they have local and international conferences that's all about threat professionals. And the ones that I've been to, When work will allow me to be off to go to it, I can only usually go for 1 or 2 days, and the presentations are just off the hook. Like Shiloh, you were there for one of the moms of a Columbine shooter, or no, it was
the Isla Vista
shooter's mom. Yeah,
they have really powerful speakers and great research, but yeah, it's a wonderful place for a lot of educators, threat assessors, law enforcement, mental health professionals to come together to learn about the best and latest research.
I mean, in all seriousness, I would love to be. So with me going into teaching, it all kind of transpired. It was weird. They were trying to find a content creation teacher. I was on the advisory board and all this, you know, it came up. It certainly wasn't convenient for me to do with my schedule to do it.
Right.
But I kind of I had like a self-check moment, because I had been, you know, I have. My third child is graduating from high school this year. So I've been through I've seen the goods and the bads of education, and I had pretty strong opinions about it. And I kind of had one of those, well, then why don't you do something about it moments? Like, they offered you a job to go into the school and be part of educating these kids. So I decided to give it a shot and do it. But I've been like trying to find my, figure out where my place is as in it, because I'm teaching broadcasting. Right. So it's not like a critical life skill for most, even 90% of my students. It's not a, you know, it's a lot of them are thing because it's fun. It's whatever. So I've just really tried to take seriously, like, what is my role here? What is my role with these kids? Like, what is important? And for me, it's a big part of it has been, you know, I may not teach them to go out, you know, they may not leave here and be news broadcasters, but if they,
but that's not the point,
right?
The point is that you're giving them, you have incredible life experience. You have an incredible background that has now come to bear in an opportunity to do something that our educational system has really moved away from. You're teaching critical thinking skills. You're teaching, you know, which involves, like, that's investigation. Investigation is like looking at all the factors in a bigger sort of a bigger perspective, a macro view.
It's critical thinking. Absolutely. Which needs to be taught in schools.
Right.
Absolutely. And then also life skills, which is, you know, we've moved in our educational system towards so much standardized testing prep that people are graduating from high school with no life skills. You know, the fact that you're teaching somebody about the process of, okay, well, you got to get equipment. How do you get equipment? You have to figure out how to get set up with this platform or this, like, all of those skills translate and generalize to other areas of life.
Even finding information and using. So I have right now that my students are doing a project, like they're making a documentary about a topic they're interested in. And so I went, mm-hmm. I spent a half hour with a student yesterday going through, she's doing hers on dream theory and was trying to, and I was like, well, you need to have some interviews. Like, well, who can I interview? I'm like, okay, well, let's think about it. Who could be an expert on that? Well, nobody here. I'm like, okay, well, the world's is a pretty small place with the internet. And so like we're going through and she's going through websites and firing off emails to Harvard professors.
It's so cool.
You know, just like learning how to do that. But another element for me too is the relational side of it is, you know, I feel like if I get a kid that maybe really never mastered video editing in the course of this class, but they feel like when they have a problem that they have somebody that they can trust and that actually cares about them, that they can come in and talk to about it. Like the student that I mentioned to, you know, a few minutes ago, like that was, this past week was the final day for seniors. They had their last day and their big walkout. And it was just like, it was such an emotional day for me. Cause like they were leaving and I had so many of them like come back and give me a hug. Aww. And thank me. And it was just, you know, as they're leaving, it's just like, well, okay, well there's, you've been looking for how are you? And I do that with, I overthink everything. My wife will tell you that. But but everything for me is like, my time is so limited. I want to be purposeful in anything I'm doing and the podcast and anything. And I'm like, where is the impact? Where's the impact I made? And is some of the things the kid said to me and, you know, the emotional moments that we had, I was like, okay, well, that's an impact. That's a real life impact that we had on that. And,
exactly.
And if my role in that school could be to help understand better, like the threat assessments and things like that, if that's another role that I can add by going to Disney World with Dr. Shiloh, then I'm
it's Disneyland. It's not Florida.
Disneyland. Florida. I'm happy to do that. Like,
well, it's interesting. Do you know if your school or if your district has a threat assessment protocol and what that is at all?
I don't
because
know.
If they don't, you could help build that. I'm going to send you some additional resources from a really great place to start.
Okay.
But you could be if they don't know, and a lot of districts do not have anything in place. It doesn't have to be fancy. It just has to be entities talking to each other and working with each other. And offline, we're happy to consult because this is, you know, what Scott follows up on in his daily work too. So
yeah, that would be great. But
I'm going to send you some stuff.
I appreciate that. Yeah, because that'd be really cool for me to do. And I'd be, like I said, and it's another thing that I can do next year where that could maybe be, you know, I just want to be part of a solution, you know, part of making things better.
Good.
I do want to circle back there while I'm talking about my you can tell that this is a big chunk of my life for the last year, because if you listen to every episode, somehow I end up talking about me teaching my teenagers.
I know. That's wonderful.
But with you guys, I want to talk about you guys have been on like a 6-week hiatus and you just came back. So if everybody's been dying, let me back up a little bit just in case there's people listening that are not familiar or haven't checked out LA Not So Confidential yet. Can you explain to us, what is your show? What is, if somebody goes to check out your podcast, what are they going to hear?
So our show is basically a reflection of the work that Shiloh and I do, and our perspective on true crime and popular media. So we're both psychologists, but we work in forensic capacities, and for even, you know, there's a lot of things that psychologists can do, and there's a lot of stuff within forensics, which is the intersection of criminology, the justice system, and any other sort of area. So as forensic psychologist, Shiloh, and you know, turned to me one day after coffee, you know, years ago, and said, you know, there's not anybody in true crime at that time. There are some now. There's nobody that has our credentials that are continuing to work currently in the field that are producing content. And, you know, with some cajoling and encouragement, because I was like, oh, I can't do another project. I can't take anything else on. But we ended up committing to it. And so ours is a forensic psychology and true crime podcast. And what we attempt to do is give the psych background on some of the crimes that occur. Some of the perpetrators we can look at, especially historical stuff, we can bring up and say, you know, these are some of the profile elements. These are some of the elements from their childhood that definitely impacted this. Sort of a post-mortem forensic work in a way. And then it morphed into doing vintage crime episodes. And then, as Shiloh was saying earlier, reviewing these documentaries and giving perspectives on it. So, you know, sometimes we're more story driven. Sometimes we're more psych oriented, but a lot of times, and we've, you know, we're 200 plus episodes in, we're talking about how a mental health issue, a mental health diagnosis, mental health influence has a direct correlation to the crimes that are being committed. And it's worked out really well for us.
Yeah, it's fantastic. It's one of the, as my audience knows, I don't have a whole lot of time to listen to many true crime podcasts, but you guys are always on my, one of the few that are on my queue. And you're back. So, you got episodes coming back out again. And, Shiloh, you had mentioned to me that you guys, that you have what you described as kind of a big episode coming out. What'd you say, at the end of the month?
Yeah, it's going to be, the last Wednesday of the month. I think that's May 29th. So we are diving back in sort of to what we were talking about. And so before our hiatus, we did a couple big episodes on sovereign citizens and some extremist ideologies, which we'd never shy away from. You know, 2020 was big for like us diving into the psychology of QAnon and like online cults and, obviously, incels ideology has been something that we've covered and we've presented on around the world at this point, live to law enforcement agencies, to, you know, CrimeCon UK and some other entities. But we are doing an episode coming up on extremism in the military and law enforcement. Mm. So after the January 6th attempted insurrection, right, we then found out that there was a huge percentage of folks there that day that were active military or active in law enforcement, which is quite concerning, right? So, so basically what we did in this upcoming episode is we break down the research that's there. It's not a lot. There definitely needs to be more, but it was really interesting to find some of the hypotheses presented by researchers, particularly from the RAND Corporation or the RAND entity, looking at the fact that these folks that have extremist ideologies that are in the military or law enforcement have histories of being exposed to trauma, whether it be combat trauma, physical abuse, sexual abuse, as well as having a hard time transitioning out of military and first responder life. And a lot of these folks, the majority of them actually, in the bigger samples that they did studies on, actually were joining these extremist groups after retirement or after they had left the military or law enforcement. So there seems to be a nexus there, interestingly, about kind of, you know, missing that brotherhood, missing that esprit de corps that you kind of find in those professions, and being in a vulnerable place in their life where they then find it. Almost like Scott and I have talked about this before, like anyone's kind of susceptible to a cult. It just has to be the right cult at the right time in your life.
Right.
Right. So it's, go ahead, Scott.
I was just going to say they can miss that camaraderie, like you were saying, but they can also miss, they can also miss the identification with being part of military or paramilitary groups.
Right.
And the sort of the prestige that comes with that, which also kind of leaks over into another study we did or another episode we did on stolen valor.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's about wanting to, you know, we all as humans, I mean, there are some people that are more introverts that are more sort of solo, I want to go my own way type of people. But, you know, we are wired for community and connection, and that's how we've survived as a species. But sometimes that wiring can hook you up and make you susceptible to extremist beliefs without sort of without venturing outside of an echo chamber. You got to break that bubble and get outside of it.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn. But hurry, these offers won't last forever. Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
As you guys were describing that, that makes it, so me, it, you know, I was a fireman for 16 years before I started doing this work. And that was definitely like, it leaves a hole in you when you walk away from that. For me, you know, I certainly haven't fallen in. My cult is my podcast audience that works with me on these cases,
right,
and some close friends. Right. But, like, as you were describing that, I'm like, yeah, like I remember when I walked away from the fire department, there were so many aspects of that job that I couldn't wait to get away from. But mm-hmm. then there was that, it's like, but you know, I had this brotherhood of people that were just so close that are, you know, that, you know, and you're in life and death. So you guys know this from your work with law enforcement.
You're like, trauma bonded. You're like, yeah.
Yeah.
Pinch buddy.
Yeah, we sit around drinking coffee and shooting the shit at breakfast every day and joking and laughing and having a great time. But then a half hour later, we could be, you know, barreling into a building that's on fire, collapsing, and you have to rely on that guy next to you to keep you alive. That's a big hole to fill. So it's interesting. I'm looking forward to hearing that episode to hear how all of that kind of plays into that whole mindset.
Yeah, I think it's just, you know, sort of hypotheses at this point. There's definitely more research that needs to be done. But Scott and I just recorded that, finished our research. And then when we found out we were going to be coming on here, I was like, there was no research on like this in the firefighter world. Like, there's got to be something. And I was, you know, trying to dig. And I have not found anything. I don't doubt that, you know, it would be across the board. I think we could extrapolate it from the military to law enforcement to kind of all first responders. But I did come across a super interesting master's thesis where he's the DA of El Dorado County here in California. And his master's thesis in his program back in 2017, he was, you know, like all of us do when we're working on our dissertation, our master's thesis, we're like, okay, what topic do we pick? And I guess he had thought back to when he was prosecuting in the 90s, these cases of arson, which Bob, you and I talked about on the True Crime Binge episode, where the perpetrators ended up turning out to be firefighters themselves.
Right.
And, you know, he had gone back and looked at a research study that the FBI did where they were profiling these individuals where, like, none of them actually turned out to be pyromaniacs, which was the hypothesis before, was that they were like pyromaniacs and then they joined the fire department. Right. But it turned out that they were offenders who had dysfunctional childhoods, unstable relationships as young adults. They didn't have good social and interpersonal skills. Like, it wasn't this big, you know, fire, you know, being attracted to fire or putting, you know, setting fires. It was more that they wanted a way in which to seem heroic.
Right.
And so he was looking at that and looking at the programs they put in place. I guess there was a program called Hero to Zero in Pennsylvania. And then one called Secrets in the Firehouse in Louisiana, where it was directed at recruits. And what they started doing is warning recruits about you know, basically career implications for committing arson, mm-hmm. that if this is what you're thinking about, don't do it, essentially. But you are a firefighter. You already belong to a brotherhood. You already are accepted. You don't need to prove yourself. And so they started doing these like educational programs, and then incidents of firefighters involving themselves in incidents of arson declined. So he was saying, I wonder if, you know, if we look at religious extremists and other types of extremist ideologies, you know, he was kind of connecting these two worlds for him a little bit, because he does study in the area of threat assessment. Mm-hmm. But, you know, what if we start looking at extremists as not just someone with like this one ideology, but they're a whole person behind that, that there's a lot that led up to where they are at. And then, you know, it kind of left with like, how do we intervene with that? Like we intervened with firefighters, which I just thought fascinating. And we did not include that in our episode because I hadn't found it until then. But, you know, it's kind of harkens back to what Scott and I do on our show. Like you can have this person that did this horrible thing, but we still like what led them to that? And at the end of the day, just like you were talking about, it's a human is a human is a human.
Right.
So whether they're sitting in prison in deplorable conditions, you know, we can, Scott always uses the great example, like you can have, tons and tons of empathy for someone who, you know, has, abusive parents and is, out of their control, exposed to sexual violence very early and, you know, maybe sustains, violence and head wounds, and think of this poor child, right, in that situation. But then when that person grows up to be Richard Ramirez, all of a sudden we're like, well, fuck that guy.
Right. Yeah.
But like, come on, there's stuff going on behind the scenes.
Well, that's the thing. There's always something. It's never just the surface problem that's causing it. I learned there was, are you guys, and I say, and I know as psychologists, you, if it's a real thing, you will. I don't know. There was a guy that I used to work with when I did a lot of fire training, and I don't know if it was a concept in a company that he was building or if it was a nationwide thing, but he used to come and teach. I hired him to come teach my department. They called it resilience training, and it was based around, you know, front running PTSD. It was based on these studies. Are you guys familiar with the concept?
Yep.
Yeah. So it's not just a Michigan thing, I guess. But it was, yeah. So it was based on the concept of, you know, they researched people with PTSD or critical incident stress and that had really bad problems with it. And they kind of looked at the front end of it, like what things are common amongst this? And I really took it to heart with, you know, teaching the firefighters that I traveled and taught and my own firefighters in my own department. And it was just interesting. It was so shocking to me, the things that mattered. And I've seen it outside of, you know, the emergency services too, just with people I know, friends, family members, students that have issues. And it was like, do you, you know, having close personal, it's almost like Maslow's stuff, right? Like, do you have personal relation, meaningful personal relationships? And the one interesting one was like a belief in something greater than yourself, which was a big one for firefighters. Now that doesn't necessarily mean you're a Christian or a Muslim or whatever,
right.
You know, it's just, is there something bigger than you that you believe in? And it was shocking to me in the study how many people had really serious issues with PTSD, like the percentage of those that like didn't have that belief in something. And the way it was described to us in the fire world was, if you don't have a belief in something greater than yourself, then you become your God. And then when you fail, when you go to the fire and you can't get that kid out, or you go to that accident and you don't save their lives and that patient dies, there's no one else to look to. You were the God that just failed everything, and then everything crumbles on him.
Yes.
But it was one of those things, and obviously it's a whole big long, you know, study and discussion, but it was very interesting to me. That was kind of my first look into, before I even did this work, that there's more than meets the eye going on there. It's not just this thing you're seeing on the surface. There's something deeper. That same guy used to, and I use this model all the time when I used to teach personnel management. He used to create this diagram. It was a Z, and it was always like, when you deal with a personnel issue, it's because there was a consequence. Something happened, right? Something broke, something bad happened. And he's like, but you need to backtrack that. That consequence came from an action, and the mistake that most managers and people, teachers, whoever make is, so you correct the action. you tell him stop doing that thing. But he continued it further in the Zine Quebec. Well, every action came from a thought. They thought something before they did that thing. So let's so then the more enlightened managers of people will try to go after the thought. And he said, but there's one step before that. Before that thought, every thought comes from some core belief. And if you can figure out what that core belief is by actually having a conversation with somebody and getting to know them, if you can help address the core belief, then the thoughts change, the actions change, the consequences change, and you can correct whole.
You just taught a class on cognitive behavioral therapy right now.
Yeah, that's like what that's first order change versus second order change. You know, there's no use in putting a Band-Aid on a bleeding head wound. Right?
Right.
You have to look at what's underneath that, the severity of that wound, and patch that up before you can just, if you just fix the symptoms, you don't fix the illness or the disease behind it. I know those are kind of, you know, catchy terms, but the other thing too about,
by the way, that'll be $150.
Yes.
Is that what you get?
That's it.
Is that what psychologists get for an hour? I'm in
those
Michigan.
Those are Michigan prices.
Michigan prices. Yeah. Sorry. Go ahead, Scott.
Well, that's an interesting thing too about men and women who are transitioning out of paramilitary or emergency response careers, which is overwhelmingly still populated by men and is driven as this sort of hard charger, you know, ultimate like high adrenaline response mode. Is that, and I tell this to the cops all the time because I do these lectures twice a month for our mental health intervention training for the police force I work in tandem with, is that, you know, you're hard charging for your career of 20, 25, maybe even 30 years. Mm-hmm. And that train is going 175 miles an hour. Now it stops.
Right.
It just stops. Well, what happens? And it's like, oh, I'm going to go fishing. Well, you're going to go fishing every day. That's not realistic. You're going to read every day. That's not realistic. You have to kind of crank open these things, because if you don't crank them open, what you create is something that is very problematic in the risk and threat assessment world, is an empty vessel. Mm-hmm. So when that void is created from the lack of identity, from the lack of camaraderie, of collegial interaction, that leaves a big void for other stuff to fill it up. And, you know, there's a lot of toxic crap out there that can fill it up. You know, you can listen to the divisiveness in the political world today and get pulled in any direction, mm-hmm. and get your critical thinking skills about, like, you know, what am I viewing right now and how much actual truth is there to this? And let me use critical thinking skills. And I just see it over and over and over again. But it's not just law enforcement or fire or military, but it seems to be more prevalent in these hard charging fields. You know, you have to have a plan for what your life is going to be after you're not this thing anymore.
Yeah. And you have that, the people that make it 25 years in those professions too, are generally tend to be your type A personality. They're in charge there. And that's a whole different thing too. When you come out of it and come into society.
I'm married to one. He just retired in November.
Yeah. You know, it's one thing for me, I've had to learn, because for those 16 years, every day's a battle. Right. At some point in that day, you're going to war, whether for me, it was with a fire, whether it's a police war, whatever it is. And you had to be ready to fight. And then even when I became the chief, it was a political fight all the time, whatever it was, you know,
it's a lot.
And so I've really tried to teach myself from my personal relationships to learn to choose my battles. Right. Like, when is it okay just to, okay, you don't have to win this argument, because and also to self, like, recognize, like, in myself that, as my wife and kids or anybody close to me will tell you, like, you don't want to get into an argument with me because I will shift it into overdrive and
if
I
lose.
I have diagnosed OCD as a version of it. I have for real. I have papers. I don't just say it. In my form of it is, my brain tends to work really, really, really fast, because I'm always like playing chess with everything, five steps ahead of where I'm at. Arguments can get real ugly. So I've had to, like, teach myself to, okay, you don't need to win that. You don't have to have this argument. And that too is, like, so difficult for people from those professions. I can speak from my own personal, because we fight every battle. to like to teach right. to teach all those type A personalities to like try and just let something go. It's difficult.
Yeah, it's a lot of what I focus on. I work in police psychology now, and I see couples, law enforcement couples, and that all or nothing thinking, like you're talking about, it serves its purpose on the job to keep right. you safe, right? You got to assess, it's this or that. For police officers, is there a crime here or not? Is this person going to jail or not? Is that a gun in their hand or not? But that shit does not transition well at home or
to your spouse. No, it does not.
Yeah. You got to learn how to like, okay, there's actually gray in this world, and that's how the rest of my family thinks. But it's hard to toggle back and forth because it is a life-saving technique and thought pattern that gets created. So it's really, really tough. So kudos to you for recognizing that. I'm sure your wife made you very aware that you needed to.
Mm-hmm. Many people have made me very aware of it over the years. But you know, a lot of it too comes from me when people will come to me. I'm trying so hard not to keep circling back, but even students that have come to me with problems, right? That the relational problems that they want to talk to me about, and I'll sit back with them and be like, okay. I get the weirdest thing. I've had so many kids come to me to workshop a text message. When they're like having a personal like Mr. Ruff, like I'm trying
it's
to like
best.
Like I want to say, like I how do I say that, and I always ask them the same thing, what are you trying to accomplish,
like what's the goal in the message,
what is the goal, like is it like you're firing back and yeah you got them, but what are you trying to what do you want at the end of this? Do you still want to be friends with this person, or are you trying to end the relationship? Well, you need to think in those terms. And then like and then the 17-year-old leaves my room. And then I sit there and we're like, what the fuck are you trying to do? Why? So you ask yourself the same question. So that's been a big learning experience. So this has been amazing. And we could go on for hours, but we need to wrap it up. I have my last one that will be graduating my 13-year-old writing a book report inside. I need to see, because I'm sure he's not writing a book report inside what he's doing. But I want to bring one question from the chat. Caroline wanted to know, she said her 17-year-old, and I saw that Scott was communicating with her in the chat, but it's for everybody. She said her 17-year-old wants to go into forensic psychology. Do you have any advice or things you wish you knew when starting out?
That's what I was looking up right now. So we have an episode. It's episode 16. It's from 2019. It's called So You Want to Be a Forensic Psychologist? Because we get this question all the time. Okay. So feel free, Carolyn, to have them go and listen. And then please email us with any questions. We field questions like this all the time. 17 is a great age to start thinking about it. I would say, you know, just focus on being a good clinical psychologist first. That's baseline info.
There was also an earlier question, and I can't remember who asked it, but it was about CrimeCon UK and what we're presenting. Can we say that yet, or are we?
Yeah.
So yeah, we have a presentation that we just developed for the California Criminologists Convention that was last month or 2 months ago, and it's going to be on the phenomenon of self-victimization. There's not a lot of people that talk about this, about the psych background of people who present themselves as victims.
Like false victimization, hoaxes and gone girls.
Some of them are, you know, we talk about the different motivations about why you get there. It might be for money, for negotiations, and it might come from the delusion that you are being assaulted or you're being stalked or harassed. And we found some fascinating information on it. So we're developing that for the convention circuit as well.
Awesome. All right. Well, with that being said, I think we'll go ahead and wrap this up. But again, thank you guys so much. What a fascinating guy. We should just have a monthly chat about my armchair psychology-ing. But it's the most, to me, human beings, people are the most interesting thing to me, and having meaningful, impactful moments and relationships with them. And you guys are fantastic at helping educate people, and you're doing great work over in LA Not So Confidential. So for those of you listening, go ahead and check that out. They're two of the good ones. Dr. Shiloh, Dr. Scott, thank you guys so much for joining me.
Thanks you for the opportunity. Thanks.
We'll see you in the Berkshires.
Yes.
Yay.
Thank you. Truth and Justice is an NBI Studios production. All music for the show is created and composed by Shane Yoder at PutThemInASong.com. The font you see on all of our logos and banners were created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. Katie Ross of CreatedInTandem.com designed, created, manages, and maintains our website, Truth and Justice Pod, where you can view all photos and documents discussed in every episode. Thank you to our volunteer transcription team, Pamela Westby, Kathy McElhaney, Courtney Wimberly, Erica Cantor, Melissa Cardenas, Kaywood Yomnick, and Danielle Rohr. And as always, thank you to all of you for your engagement and your support. If you like the show and you want to support us, you can do that in a number of ways. The number one way for you to support our work is to become a patron at patreon.com/truthandjustice. If you join our Patreon, not only will you be financially supporting our work, but you'll also get something for your pledge. For just $5 per month, you'll get all episodes ad-free and also a video version of the Friday follow-ups that include an hour-long pre-show chat exclusive to our patrons. Other levels will get you a Truth and Justice Army t-shirt, Truth and Justice hats, and even the opportunity to co-host a Friday follow-up episode. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. It doesn't cost you a penny, and it goes a long way towards making the show more visible. If you have a case that you'd like us to consider covering, you can submit your cases on our website, truthandjusticepod.com. Just click on the case submission button and fill out the form. And the most important thing that you can do is engage in our investigations. You can keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page, follow us on Instagram, or join in on the conversation on the Truth and Justice Podcast fans page. For all of you tweeters out there, you can connect with us on Twitter @TruthJusticePod, and I can be found on social media @BobRuffTruth. However you do it, stay engaged, stay in touch. But as for now, I'm signing off. I'm Bob Ruff, and this has been Truth and Justice.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.